Today, we can feel very fortunate because we're here with Shishi Radha Madan Mohan. We have two arms, two legs. We have eyes. If someone offered you $1 million for your arms today, would you give your arms for $1 million? How about for $10 million? Would you give up your arms? Okay, $1 billion for your arms and your legs. No? So then basically, you're walking billionaires. And that's just the beginning. We have arms, legs, ears. These are all gifts from the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Through the His kindness, especially the human body He's given us. This opportunity where these gates of the body open up and they're designed in such a way, Shotram Chakshu Sparshanam Cha Rasanam Granam Evacha Adishtayam Anaschayam Vishayan Upasevate. They're custom made just for us. They've been given as a gift. It's inestimable how valuable it is, the gift we've been given, this human body, and therefore Shastra says, Labham Sudulabham Idam Bahusam Bhavante. You can't get this by paying for it. There's no price on it. It's so, so valuable. So we have that. And then out of all the places that we could have been born in the universe, somehow or other, we're born on this Bardvarsha, on this special planet where Krishna has an outpost. And we are born at a particular time when just a few minutes ago, Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu has performed his Leela and inaugurated the Yuga Dharma just a few minutes ago, really, in even geological time. It's just a few seconds. And now we're in the midst of it. And we have these precious books which are coming from the spiritual world. The vibration's been written down, and because somehow we're living at a time when there's technology, they've been mass-produced, and there's ways to broadcast these things. So we have a short window of opportunity, this human body we've been given, to fully utilize, to the best of our ability, the opportunity of going back home, back to Godhead. So one must be dexterous to cheat death, because death is waiting to cheat us. She's a big cheater. She'll come in after we've accumulated everything and just take it all away and say, sorry, that's it, it's all gone. And everyone stands with their mouth gaping open like, what happened? So those who are intelligent, they cheat death before death cheats them. And the way to do that is to fully absorb one's mind in Krishna. Krishna says, manmana bhavamad bhakto, you should just think of me. And in the Srimad Bhagavatam, it's mentioned that the impersonalists, they're called Rikta Matayo. You know this verse? It has the words Rikta Matayo. It means, Rikta means empty. So Rikta Matayo means their head is empty. They're empty-headed because they think God is impersonal or void. And therefore, they're at a disadvantage. But the bhaktas, they're not rikta matayo, manmana bhavamad bhakto. They fill their minds with Krishna. And therefore, they are able, the bhaktas, to overcome the strong waves of material existence because they're absorbed in the sweetness of Krishna. So we're going to hear from the Brahma Sanhita, which is this quintessential Vaishnava literature, which was personally handed to us by Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu through his associates. It's come down to us, and it contains all the truths about Vaishnavism. So we should be particularly attentive when we hear this literature to hear all the different aspects of Vaishnava Siddhanta, and every verse practically in the Brahma Samhita is directive towards going back home, back to Godhead. It gives us a clear idea what the spiritual world is, who all the demigods are, what our duty in life is, and how to attain it. So let's hear first the translations of the Sri Brahma Sanghita by reading 5 translations each. Let's line up the microphones ahead of time so everyone's ready. And then after that, we'll chant the Sanskrit. Krishna, who is known as Govinda, is the Supreme Godhead. He has an eternal, blissful, spiritual body. He is the origin of all. He has no other origin, and he is the prime cause of all causes. The spiritual place of transcendental pastimes of Krishna is portrayed in the second verse. The super-excellent station of Krishna, which is known as Gokula, has thousands of petals and a corolla like that of a lotus, sprouted from a part of his infinitary aspect. The world of leaves being the actual abode of Krishna. The whorl of that transcendental lotus is the realm wherein dwells Krishna. It is a hexagonal figure, the abode of the indwelling, predominated and predominating aspect of the Absolute. Like a diamond, the central supporting figure of self-luminous Krishna stands as the transcendental source of all potencies. The holy name, consisting of 18 transcendental letters, is manifested in a hexagonal figure with 6-fold divisions. The whorl of that eternal realm, Gokula, is the hexagonal abode of Krishna. Its petals are the abodes of gopis, who are part and parcel of Krishna, to whom they are most lovingly devoted and are similar in essence. The petals shine beautifully like so many walls. The extended leaves of that lotus are the garden-like dham, that is the spiritual abode of Sri Radhika, the most beloved of Krishna. The surrounding external plane of Gokula is described in this verse. There is a mysterious quadrangular place named Shvetadvip surrounding the outskirts of Gokula. Shvetadvip is divided into 4 parts on all sides. The abode of Vasudev, Sankarshan, Pradyumna, and Aniruddha are separately located in each of these 4 parts. These 4 divided abodes are enveloped by the 4-fold human requirements such as piety, wealth, passion, and liberation, as also by the 4 Vedas, namely Rig, Sama, Yajur, and Atharva, which deal with the mantra and which are the basis of achievements of the 4-fold mundane requirements. 10 tridents are fixed in the 10 directions, including the zenith and nadir. The 8 directions are decorated with the 8 jewels of Mahapadma, Padma, Shankha, Makara, Kachapa, Mukunda, Kunda, and Nila. There are 10 protectors, Dikpalas, of the 10 directions in the form of mantra. The associates of the hues of blue, yellow, red, and white, and the extraordinary potencies bearing the names of Bimala, etc., shine on all sides.
The Lord of Gokula in the transcendental is the transcendental supreme personality, is the transcendental supreme Godhead, the own self of eternal ecstasies. He is the superior of all superiors and is busily engaged in the enjoyments of the transcendental realm and has no association with his mundane potency. Krishna never consorts with his illusory energy. Still, her connection is not entirely cut off from the absolute truth. When he intends to create the material world, the amorous pastime in which he engages by consorting with his own spiritual chit potency, Rama, by casting his glance at the deluding energy in the shape of sending his time energy, is an auxiliary activity. The secondary process of association with Maya is described. Rama Devi, the spiritual chit potency, beloved consort of the Supreme Lord, is the regulatrix of all entities. The divine plenary portion of Krishna creates the mundane world. At creation, there appears a divine halo of the nature of his own subjective portion, Swamsha. This halo is divine Shambhu, the masculine symbol or manifested emblem of the Supreme Lord. This halo is the dim twilight reflection of the supreme eternal effulgence. This masculine symbol is the subjective portion of divinity who functions as progenitor of the mundane world, subject to the supreme regulatrix, Niyati. The conceiving potency in regard to mundane creation makes her appearance out of the supreme regulatrix. She is Maya, the limited, non-absolute, apara potency, the symbol of mundane feminine productivity. The intercourse of those two brings forth the faculty of perverted cognition, the reflection of the seed of the procreative desire of the Supreme Lord. All offsprings of the consort of the great Lord Maheshwara of this mundane world are of the nature of the embodiment of the mundane masculine and feminine generative organs. The person embodying the material causal principle is the great Lord of this mundane world, Maheshwara, Shambhu, in the form of the male generating organ, is joined to his female consort, the limited energy Maya, as the efficient causal principle. The Lord of the world, Mahavishnu, is manifest in him by his subjective portion in the form of his glance.
The Lord of mundane world, Mahavishnu, possesses thousands of heads, eyes, and hands. He is the source of thousands of avatars and has thousands of subjective portions. He is the creator of thousands and thousands of individual souls. The same Mahavishnu is spoken of by the name of Narayana in this mundane world. From that eternal person has sprung the vast expanse of water on the spiritual causal ocean. The subjective portion of Sankarsana, who abides in Paravyoma, the above Supreme Purusha, with thousands of subjective portions, reposes in the state of divine sleep, Yoga Nidra, in the waters of spiritual causal ocean. The spiritual seeds of Sankarsana, existing in the pores of skins of Mahavishnu, are born as so many golden sperms. These sperms are covered with five great elements. The same Mahavishnu entered into each universe as his own separate subjective portions. The divine portions that enter into each universe are possessed of his majestic extension. That is, they are the eternal universal soul, Mahavishnu, possessing thousands and thousands of heads. The same Mahavishnu created Vishnu from his left limb, Brahma, the first progenitor of beings, from his right limb, and from the space between his two eyebrows, Shambhu, the divine masculine manifested halo.
The function of Shambhu in relation to Jivas is that this universe enshrining the mundane egotistic principle has originated from Shambhu. Thereupon the same great personal Godhead, assuming the threefold forms of Vishnu, Prajapati and Shambhu, entering into the mundane universe, plays the pastimes of preservation, creation and destruction of this world. This pastime is contained in the mundane world. Hence, it being perverted, the Supreme Lord, identical with Mahavishnu, prefers to consort with the goddess Yoga Nidra, the constituent of his own spiritual chit potency, full of ecstatic trance of eternal bliss appertaining to his own divine personality. When Vishnu, lying in the ocean of milk, wills to create this universe, a golden lotus springs from his navel pit. The golden lotus, with its stem, is the abode of Brahma, representing Brahmaloka or Satyaloka. Before their conglomeration, the primary elements in their nascent state remained originally separate entities. Non-application of the conglomerating process is the cause of their separate existence. Divine Mahavishnu, primal Godhead, through association with his spiritual chit potency, moved Maya and, by the application of the conglomerating principle, created those different entities in their state of cooperation. And after that, he himself consorted with Yoga Nidra by way of his eternal dalliance with his spiritual chit potency. By conglomerating all those separate entities, he manifested the innumerable mundane universes and himself entered into the inmost recess of every extended conglomerate, Virat Vigraha. At that time, those jivas who had lain dormant during the cataclysm were awakened.
The same jiva is eternal and is for eternity and without a beginning, joined to the Supreme Lord by the tie of an eternal kinship. He is transcendental spiritual potency. The divine lotus which springs from the navel pit of Vishnu is in every way related by the spiritual tie with all souls and is the origin of four-faced Brahma versed in the four Vedas. On coming out of the lotus, Brahma, being guided by the divine potency, turned his mind to the act of creation under the impulse of previous impressions. But he couldn't see nothing but darkness in every direction. Then the goddess of learning, Sarasvati, the divine consort of the Supreme Lord, said thus to Brahma, who saw nothing but gloom in all directions. O Brahma, this mantra, Klim Krishnaya Govindaya Gopijana Valabhaya Svaha, will assuredly fulfill your heart's desire. O Brahma, do thou practice spiritual association by means of this mantra, then all your desire will be fulfilled.
Brahma, being desirous of satisfying Govinda, practiced the cultural acts for Krishna in Golok, Lord of Shvetadvip, for a long time. His meditation ran thus. There exists a divine lotus of 1,000 petals, augmented by millions of filaments in the transcendental land of Golok. On its whorl there exists a great divine throne on which is seated Sri Krishna, the form of eternal effulgence of transcendental bliss, playing on his divine flute, resonant with the divine sound with his lotus mouth. He is worshipped by his amorous milkmaids with their respective subjective portions and extensions, and also by his external energy, who stays outside, embodying all mundane qualities. Then Gayatri, mother of the Vedas, being made manifest, that is, imparted by the divine sound of the flute of Sri Krishna, entered into the lotus mouth of Brahma, born from himself through his 8-year-old holes. The lotus-born Brahma, having received the Gayatri, sprung from the flute song of Sri Krishna, attained the status of the twice-born, having been initiated by the supreme primal preceptor, Godhead himself. Enlightened by the recollection of that Gayatri, embodying the three Vedas, Brahma became acquainted with the expanse of the ocean of truth. Then he worshipped Sri Krishna, the essence of all Vedas, with this hymn. I worship Govinda, the primal Lord, the first progenitor who is tending the cows, yielding all desire, in abodes built with spiritual gems, surrounded by millions of purpose trees, always served with great reverence and affection by hundreds of thousands of Lakshmis or Gopis. I worship Govinda, the primal Lord, who is adept in playing on his flute, with blooming eyes like lotus petals, with head decked with peacock feather, with the figure of beauty tinged with the hue of blue clouds, and his unique loveliness charming millions of cupids.
I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, round whose neck is swinging a garland of flowers beautified with the moon locket, whose two hands are adorned with the flute and jeweled ornaments, who always revels in pastimes of love, whose graceful threefold bending form of Samasandra is eternally manifest. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, whose transcendental form is full of bliss, truth, substantiality, and is thus full of the most dazzling splendor. Each of the limbs of that transcendental figure possesses in himself the full-fledged functions of all the organs, and eternally sees, maintains, and manifests the infinite universes, both spiritual and mundane. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, who is inaccessible to the Vedas, but obtainable by pure unalloyed devotion of the soul, who is without a second, who is not subject to decay, is without a beginning, whose form is endless, who is the beginning and the eternal Purusha. Yet he is a person possessing the beauty of blooming youth. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, only the tip of the toe of whose lotus feet is approached by the yogis who aspire after the transcendental and betake themselves to pranayama by drilling the respiration, or by the jnanis who try to find out the non-differentiated Brahman by the process of elimination of the mundane extending over thousands of millions of years. He is an undifferentiated entity as there is no distinction between the potency and the possessor thereof. In his work of creation of millions of worlds, his potency remains inseparable. All the universes exist in him and he is present in his fullness in every one of the atoms that are scattered throughout the universe at one and the same time. Such is the primal Lord whom I adore. I just want to say one thing. The other two microphones we have, when they are not in use, please turn it off because they generate static.
Are they all off? Is yours off? I adore the same Govinda, the primeval Lord, in whose praise men who are imbued with devotion sing the mantra suktas told by the Vedas by gaining their appropriate beauty, greatness, thrones, conveyances, and ornaments. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, residing in his own realm, Goloka, with Radha, resembling his own spiritual figure, the embodiment of the ecstatic potency, possessed of the 64 artistic activities, in the company of her confidant, Sakhis, embodiments of the extensions of her bodily form, permeated and vitalized by his ever-blissful spiritual rasa. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, who is Shyamasundar, Krishna himself, with inconceivable, innumerable attributes, whom the pure devotees see in their heart of hearts with the eye of devotion tinged with the salve of love. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, who manifested himself personally as Krishna and the different avatars in the world in the form of Ram, the Shringa, Vaman, etc., as his subjective portions. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, whose effulgence is the source of the non-differentiated Brahman mentioned in the Upanishads, being differentiated from the infinity of glories of the mundane universe, appears as the indivisible, infinite, limitless truth.
I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, who is the absolute substantiative principle, being the ultimate entity in the form of the support of all existence, whose external potency embodies the threefold mundane qualities, viz. Sattva, Rajas, and Tamas, and diffuses the Vedic knowledge regarding the mundane world. I worship Govinda, the primeval Lord, whose glory ever triumphantly dominates the mundane world by the activity of his own pastimes, being reflected in the mind of recollecting souls as the transcendental entity of ever-blissful cognitive rasa. Lowest of all is located Devidham, mundane world. Next above it is Maheshdham, abode of Mahesh. Above Maheshdham is placed Haridham, abode of Hari. And above them all is located Krishna's own realm named Goloka. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, who has allotted their respective authorities to the rulers of those graded realms. The external potency Maya, who is of the nature of the shadow of the chit potency, is worshipped by all people as Durga, the creating, preserving, and destroying agency of this mundane world. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda in accordance with whose will Durga conducts herself. Just as milk is transformed into curd by the action of acids, but yet the effect curd is neither same as nor different from its cause milk, so I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, of whom the state of Shambhu is a transformation for the performance of the work of destruction.
The light of one candle, being communicated to other candles, although it burns separately in them, is the same in its quality. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, who exhibits himself equally in the same mobile manner in his various manifestations. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, who, assuming his own great subjective form, who bears the name of Shesha, replete with all accommodating potency and reposing in causal ocean with the infinity of the world in the pose of his head, enjoys creative sleep, Yoga Nidra. Brahma and other lords of the mundane worlds, appearing from the pose of the hair of Mahavishnu, remain alive as long as the duration of one exhalation of the latter, Mahavishnu. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, of whose subjective personality Mahavishnu is a portion of portion. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, from whom the separated subjective portion Brahma receives his power from the regulation of the mundane world, just as the sun manifests some portion of his own light in all the effulgent gems that bear the names of Suryakanta, etc. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, whose lotus feet are always held by Ganesha upon the pair of tumuli protruding from his elephant head in order to obtain power of his function of destroying all the obstacles on the path of progress of the three worlds.
The three worlds are composed of the nine elements, namely fire, earth, ether, water, air, direction, time, soul, and mind. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, from whom they originate, in whom they exist, and into whom they enter at the time of universal cataclysm. The sun, who is the king of all the planets, full of infinite effulgence, the image of the good soul, is as the eye of this world. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, in pursuance of whose order the sun performs his journey, mounting the wheel of time. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, by whose conferred power are maintained the manifested potencies that are found to exist of all virtues, all vices, the Vedas, the penances, and all jivas, from Brahma to the meanest insect. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, who burns up to their roots all fruitive activities of those who are imbued with devotion, and impartially ordains for each the due enjoyment of the fruit of one's activities, of all those who walk in the path of work in accordance with the chain of their previously performed works, no less in the case of the tiny insect that bears the name of Indragopa than in that of Indra, the king of Devas. I adore the primeval Lord Govinda, the meditators of whom, by meditating upon him under the sway of wrath, amorous passion, natural friendly love, fear, parental affection, delusion, reverence, and willing service, attain to bodily forms befitting the nature of their contemplation.
I worship that transcendental seat known as Shvetadvipa, where as loving consort the Lakshmis, in their unalloyed spiritual essence, practice the amorous service of the Supreme Lord Krishna as their only lover, where every tree is transcendental purpose tree, where the soul in the purpose gem, all waters is nectar, every word is a song, every gate is a dance, the flute in the favored attendant, effulgence in full of transcendental bliss and the supreme spiritual entities are all enjoyable and tasty, where numberless milk cows always emit transcendental ocean of milk, where there is eternal existence of transcendental time, who is ever present and without past or future, and hence is not subject to the quality of passing away, even for the space of half a moment. That realms is known as Goloka only to a very few self-realized souls in this world. On hearing these hymns containing the essence of the truth, the Supreme Lord Krishna said to Brahma, "Brahma, if you experience the inclination to create offspring by being endowed with the real knowledge of the glory of Godhead, listen, my beloved, from me to this science set for the following five slokas. When the pure spiritual experience is exciting by means of cognition and service bhakti, super excellent and alloyed devotional characterized by love for Godhead is awakened towards Krishna, the beloved of all souls. The highest devotion is attained by slow degrees by the method of constant endeavor for self-realization with the help of scriptural evidence, theistic conduct and perseverance and practice. This preliminary practice of devotion, sadhana bhakti, are conduced to the realization of loving devotion. Loving devotion, that whom there is no superior well-being who goes hand in hand with the attachment of the exclusive state of supreme bliss and who can lead to myself.
Abandoning all meritorious performances, serve me with faith. The realization will correspond to the nature of one's faith. The people of the world act ceaselessly in pursuance of some ideal. By meditating on me by means of those deeds, one will obtain devotion characterized by love in the shape of supreme service. Listen, O Vidhi, I am the seed that is the fundamental principle of this world of animate and inanimate objects. I am Pradhan, the substance of matter. I am Prakriti, material cause. And I am Purusha, efficient cause. This fiery energy that belongs specially to the Brahman that inheres in you has also been confirmed by me. It is by bearing this fiery energy that you regulate this phenomenal world of animate and inanimate objects.
So, I was thinking that it would be nice to have a PowerPoint presentation of all the verses. And when we do the Brahma Samhita recitation, that what we'll do is we'll show it up here, and then the audience at home, we can point the camera towards the, so that otherwise they have something active they can follow along with. So we can start this great project. Shradadevi Dasi raised her hand. So we can do this gradually. You don't have to do it all at once, but it would be nice to, we could start just with the shlokas, which would be fairly straightforward, although a daunting task unto itself. And then gradually we can add images as we find them, and it'll be a nice project. And then it'll be the first of our multimedia presentations here, because what we'd like to do is, you know, for our broadcasts, for classes and all kinds of recitations, have a mixture of things that people at home can look at on their computer screen that are in concert with the class, that are interesting, that, and they can also follow along and see the shlokas and everything. Okay? So this is a big day. We're making a quantum leap. I also thought of another thing, and that is, in these little gift packs that we give out to the new people when they come, you know, we give a few books and things like that. I think from Uline or one of the other companies, we can get a tiny little bottle, like just a tiny little thing, and it will fill it with Ganga Jal, and we can put that in also. A little combination of things. That'll be really inexpensive to get, you know, several thousand tiny little bottles. And we have lots of Ganga Jal, and we'll put those in too in the bag. So I think it'd be nice to have a variety of things. And that might even go with the this box that you're going to put out. Hare Krishna, how are you two this morning? You're working on a basket for a little beautifully wrapped prasadam. Who's making? Oh, nice. Bhavani. Bhavani's making a basket. So I was thinking, I was also just envisioning these little tiny bottles of Ganga Jal, and we can put a little label on it also. But that'll be a nice gift also, because it's like when people, I was thinking of Charnamrit, you know, from the deities. That might also be a thing, if as long as it doesn't have any milk product in it, because it'll spoil. But if we can also, because people come and it'd be nice to give them along with their gift or the prasadam, just a tiny little thing of Charnamrit that they can actually take home from the deities were bathed, and then we'll put that in a little bottle, either that or Ganga Jal. What do you think? He likes it. Do you like it? Are you too happy today? Happy? On a scale of 1 to 10? 10 is you're in ecstasy, and 1 means that you're crying. 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. We said this morning that we're all very wealthy. Just imagine if someone offered you today $1 million for one of your arms, would you give it? How about you give $1 million for an arm?
I don't.
He He wouldn't give $1 million for an arm. How about $10 million for your arm? Will you give it? How about $1 billion for one arm? Kameshri? So that means you're a walking billionaire. What to speak of all the... I mean, it's inestimable how valuable what we have, what we've been given, this human body, that has full facility. So wherever we are in the world, whatever situation we're in, these are all arrangements by Krishna. And Krishna mentions in the Bhagavad Gita, just at the very beginning, to Arjuna. Arjuna didn't like where he was. He was in a tough situation on the battlefield of Kukshetra. And then he turned to Krishna and he said, "What should I do?" And Krishna says, "Tolerate, titiksha. Learn to tolerate, because these things come and go. Everything comes and goes. It's moving in the external world. And the mind is what reacts to everything. In my mind, I take reactions and I identify with the mind, and therefore I suffer because of the moving nature of this world. But if I identify with the Atma is steady, it's permanent, and it has qualities of knowledge, bliss, eternality. And if I learn to identify with the Atma, then all the changing world around me doesn't affect my consciousness. And there are desires that enter into the realm of my mind, but the self-realized person is not disturbed by those, just as with rivers entering into the ocean, it's never overflowing. It stays at the same level. So we have to learn to be tolerant. There is no material adjustment. There's no material adjustment that can make us happy. That's what everyone's trying to do in the material world. Adjust, 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 adjust. And by adjusting materially, I think that, okay, now I'm going to be okay. This is compared to carrying a heavy weight I have on my one shoulder, and then I think, okay, I'll transfer it over to this shoulder. And now after a while, I put it on my head, and now I'll carry it like this. And oh, it's better now. Only for a few seconds it's better, and then you feel, oh, I'm still carrying the weight. So that weight we carry is this, the mind is our, can be our best friend or our worst enemy. So through regulation and bhakti. Today, we're talking about filling the mind with Krishna. The verse I was mentioning, yet pada pankacha palasha vilasya bhaktya. It's about Krishna's lotus feet and how those who are devotees, they meditate on Krishna's lotus feet. That's why we're here. We've come here as a way to concentrate on Krishna, to remember Krishna. That's what all this is about. This whole arrangement we have here is that we can come sit together. We have books. Krishna has appeared in his deity form. He has appeared in the form of the holy name. And in a concentrated way, we're coming together so that we can hear about Krishna and fill our mind with Krishna. And that's his first instruction. Manmana bhava madbhakto. Just fill your mind with me. And the more I fill my mind with Krishna, then I become satisfied. And the verse says it, yet pada pankacha palasha vilasya bhaktya. Karmashayam gratitam utgratayanti santa. Tadvanna riktam atayo yatayo pirudha shrotoganas tamaranam bhajavasudeva. And this verse says that people who are riktam atayo, there are many people who try to empty their mind. They don't have anything in it. That's what riktam atayo means. They're empty-headed. Rikta matayo, but then they get overwhelmed by the external nature. There are desires that come, there are miseries that come, and they get tipped over by those kinds of things. But the devotees are experiencing an inner satisfaction. Yet pada pankacha palasha vilasya bhaktin. It describes how Krishna's lotus feet are very beautiful, and they attract the attention of the devotee. That service, when we do service to Krishna and he actually reveals the beauty of the tips of his toes to the devotee, and that satisfies the devotee's heart. And therefore, the devotee is not attracted by any of the external features of the material world. And he can't be tipped over by the desires that enter into the mind or by any of the external features of the Lord. And also, by thinking of Krishna's lotus feet, the knots within the heart are untied. Yet pada pankacha palasha vilasa bhaktya. karmashayam gratitam. That means karmashayam, there's a way that I've become all tied up by the desires in the heart. Gratitam, it's a hard knot. But that can be untied just by thinking of Krishna. In fact, do you know about Krishna's lotus feet? Anybody? What do you know about them?
If you worship that with his feet.
Use your microphone.
Yeah, I heard in lecture that if you worship the lotus feet of Krishna, then the material world would be like the hoof print of a calf.
So by taking shelter of Krishna's lotus feet, then the ocean of material existence, which is very difficult to overcome, it shrinks up into this size, the hoof print of a calf. What do Krishna's lotus feet look like? Yes?
Lotus.
They look like a lotus. They resemble a lotus. What else? Any other features?
The toenails are very shining and effulgent. There's light.
Toenails are shiny and effulgent. What else? Other features?
Has some symbols.
Okay, has some symbols. He's ready to jump in on this. Give him to.
Madhvacharya glorifies Krishna's lotus feet in his famous Dvadasha Stotra. He explains Krishna. He glorifies Krishna from toe to top of his head. He says about his lotus feet. His lotus feet always shines with the effulgence of the crowns of the demigods when they bow down to the lotus feet of the Lord.
Just see.
So, this golden lotus.
Golden lotus. And you're going to tell some features.
Yes.
How could you tell if you see a footprint somewhere nearby here if it's Krishna's footprint or just an ordinary footprint?
It has a mark of a flag.
Yes.
A thunderbolt.
Yes.
And a wheel.
Yes. Barleycorn.
Barleycorn.
So this thunderbolt is on Krishna's lotus foot. The yogis, they meditate on this thunderbolt, and a thunderbolt can come down and smash a mountain, just smash it with its great force. So that thunderbolt marking on Krishna's lotus feet, if there's a mountain of sins within my heart and their reactions, that thunderbolt comes and smashes that mountain of sins and it breaks it to pieces. So if you meditate on Krishna's lotus feet and that thunderbolt, then it will smash the mountain of sins, whatever is accumulated within your heart. And then you'll be happy.
Is there any picture of how that thunderbolt mark looks like? Because I always wondered how it looks like.
You'll have to come to Vrindavan and look for it. Just like Akura, when he came to Vrindavan, all the way to Vrindavan, he was thinking about Krishna. Especially he was thinking about his eyes, and he was thinking about Krishna's lotus eyes, and he was also thinking about his hand, about how beautiful Krishna's hands are. And he was thinking that when Krishna and Balaram saw him, they'd say, "Oh, uncle," and they'd put their hand there, beautiful hand on his head, and that then his life would be perfect. And then when he got to the precincts of Vrindavan, just there he saw Krishna's footprints in Vrindavan. Krishna's footprints are all over Vrindavan, you know, because he walks around there everywhere. He never leaves Vrindavan. So when you go there, you can look. And he noticed when he looked down and he saw that, he saw the impressions of the thunderbolt, the flag, the wheel, the barleycorn, all these markings were there. And he fell off his chariot. And he rolled on the ground in that dust, and he smeared his whole body with that dust. So that's what you're supposed to do when you arrive in Vrindavan. You should roll out of your taxi cab onto the ground and take that dust from Vrindavan and smear it on your body. So you'll have to come and see what it looks like. There are some places where Krishna's lotus feet is. One place you see a footprint of Krishna is at the Radha-Damodar Mandir in Vrindavan. That's the place Prabhupada stayed. And who's been to the Radha-Damodar Mandir? Did you see Krishna's lotus foot? Did you see it? They keep it on the altar.
It's so far away.
It's kind of far away, but it's about this big. And what happened was Sanatana Goswami used to walk around Govardhan Hill every day. It's a long way around. It's about 14 miles walk. It's an athletic event, actually, if you go every day. You have to stay in real shape. Just about this time of year, I start walking very vigorously just to get ready for the walking around Govardhan Hill. But he'd walk every day. But then he got old, and it was very difficult for him to go around Govardhan Hill. And everyone was telling him, you know, including Krishna, said, you know, you don't have to do this anymore. But he wanted to. He made a vow. So Krishna, while he was standing there on Govardhan Hill, he, out of the ecstasy, Govardhan Hill was feeling, it melted and it made an impression of Krishna's lotus foot. And then Krishna gave that impression to Sanatan Goswami, that big Shila, and he said, now all you have to do is walk around this four times every day, and that's the same as going around Govardhan Hill the entire way. So now that Shila is at the Radhanamadar Mandir. So when you come to Radhanamadar, you'll see that everyone comes to the temple and they'll circumambulate four times because it's the same as going around Govardhan Hill. And then they have darshan. Every once in a while, they'll bring that Shila out and people crowd in to see, and they give tons and tons of rupees when they come out, you know. And then, you know, you can get a little vision of Krishna's lotus foot. And there you can see for yourself what impressions are there on Krishna's lotus feet. And? Radharani's lotus feet, we won't go there. Too esoteric. So Krishna says, meditate on my form, think of me, think of my pastimes, think of my name. And the result will be, if you think of Krishna, what is the result?
The result is that we cross over the ocean of birth and death and go back to the spiritual world, to his own abode.
And what about for today? How will I feel today if I meditate on Krishna's lotus feet? You'll feel happiness?
Krishna's transcendental. The root words are Krishna, means now would become, it would give you a lot of pleasure.
So you feel happiness and pleasure by thinking of Krishna's lotus feet. So we have to fill our mind with Krishna, because otherwise the mind's filled with all kinds of difficulties and problems. Are there difficulties and problems in the world? Yes or no?
Yes.
Is it just me? Does everyone have difficulties and problems, or just a few people? Does everyone have difficulties and problems in the world?
Most
or all?
All
of the 14 worlds. Does it say that in Shastra, that everyone in this whole material universe has problems? Or is everything perfect for everybody? Wherever you go, it just automatically works out, goes your way every time. So Krishna says, from topmost planet down to the bottommost planet. Does that cover every place? Does it cover every place? Does it cover San Jose? So Krishna says, from topmost planet down to the bottommost planet, all are places of misery, where repeated birth and death take place. It's a dukkhalayam, it's a place of misery. So do we expect happiness in this place from the external circumstances? Do we? Unfortunately, yes. This is Maya, it's a folly. But the only way to actually become happy is wherever we are, whatever situation we're in, is to fill our mind with Krishna. It's a simple formula. I have to think of Krishna, remember Krishna. And if I can't think of Krishna, then what's a simple process to automatically remember him?
Working for him.
You can work for him. And give me the Yuga Dharma.
Sure.
You can say, Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. So we should practice this. Whatever situation we're in, this is yoga. We have to reconnect with Krishna. If I'm fearful, if I'm in anxiety, if someone becomes my enemy, if I become disturbed, then what should I do? Hare Krishna, Hare Krishna, Krishna Krishna, Hare Hare. Hare Rama, Hare Rama, Rama Rama, Hare Hare. What if I stop chanting Hare Krishna and I just try to fix the problem? Will I be able to fix it? Yes or no? Can you fix all your problems? No, yes.
We feel like we can fix some of the problems. And many times we stop chanting and try to fix the problem.
Try to fix the problem.
Or sometimes we hurry up chanting or to try to fix the problems.
That's a good point, because if we take it that by chanting Hare Krishna, then I'll fix all my problems from that point of view. It's from a spiritual point of view, I'll fix all my problem. Just say, I'll do this first, no matter what. I'll have this base, I'll chant Hare Krishna. And it's a really good idea when we chant Hare Krishna every day to actually think of Krishna, actually hear the holy name, and try very deeply, as hard as I might try, for instance, to find happiness in the material world. And people try very hard. They look here, there, and everywhere to try to find it. I should try that hard every day to find Krishna in his name, to hear Krishna in his name, to pray to Krishna when I'm chanting. Now, if you're able to do this, if you're able to find happiness in Krishna's name and to think of Krishna no matter where you are and experience happiness in your heart and peaceful mind, therefore, no matter where you are, whatever the situation, then you become the most happy person in the world. Happiness isn't a result of our external environment. It's not a matter of where I move to or what my adjustment is. Have you ever been to Hawaii? Honolulu, Hawaii? The island of Oahu is called paradise. The breeze is there, 72 degrees every day. And sometimes there's clouds and they put out little misting raindrops. So in the sun, it feels very good on your skin. And the wind is very pleasing. And the aroma of the flowers. Everywhere there's champak flowers growing. You can get coconuts there. Would you like to go? Do you think it's a place of happiness? Did you know there are hospitals there in Hawaii? I visited the hospital. I broke my arm when I was in Hawaii. And I went to the emergency room. And I saw that people are suffering just like everywhere else. And people who go to Hawaii, they think they're going to become happy there. And because of some material environment that seems pleasing, actually the misery there is even more, because they think this is going to be a happy place, and then they're so disappointed when they get there. Some people, they save their whole life to go to Hawaii. They live in the Midwest of America, and they think our big chances come to go to Hawaii. And they get there, and somebody charges them too much for the hotel, and then they have to get a rent-a-car, and there's a problem with the rent-a-car. They didn't get the color they wanted. And then they have to figure out where to eat, and they charge too much for their food, and the man's in anxiety that I'm paying too much. How will I be able to afford this vacation? And one thing after another, there's a river of miseries and anxieties that flow into the heart of the person who comes there, into the mind. So you can go to a heavenly place. Just imagine on this planet, this is kind of a heavenly place. Or you can go to the heavenly planets. Or you can move anywhere. Or you can get a big sum of money. What if you got $1 billion someone gave you? Would that solve your problems? You sure? It looks like it, except what? You're not sure what might happen, huh? Have you ever been given something that seems very valuable? Some material thing?
My experience in the sense, you know, from what I hear and all those things is that when money comes, distress also follows it.
Uh-huh. So it doesn't solve it. You can get a lot of money. All of a sudden, someone gives you $1 billion, and then all your friends who you thought you were your enemies, they start calling you and saying, "Hi, how are you? You want to get together?" And there are actually books written about people who win the lottery. They follow them for many years, and they see that so many of them become morose and unhappy because they don't know who their friends are anymore. And they also get an anxiety about this great burden that's on their head about how to spend it. And most of them end up less happy, and they also lose their money in a few years. So that's not a solution. Just by getting material wealth is not a solution. So we're saying right here in this little room, based on great authorities like Krishna and the great acharyas who are beyond the control of the material senses, who've experienced it for themselves, that if you fill your mind with Krishna, then you'll become happy. Otherwise not. And that everyone's suffering in some way or another. And that if I think that by some kind of adjustment, if I move here or move there or get this or don't get that, that that's going to make the difference in my happiness. This is illusion. And I'm chasing after something that will never give me happiness. So we must become yogis, actual yogis. And I read this morning in the Srimad Bhagavatam, Prabhupada says that frustration, he talked about Maharaj Parikshit and how he became frustrated, so frustrated he uncharacteristically hung a snake around the neck of the great sage, Shamika Rishi. And afterwards he was cursed by the sage's son, Sringi. And Prabhupada mentions how the frustration that comes to a devotee is actually Krishna. It's Krishna pushing you so that you'll dig deeper, so that you'll actually come to this level of taking shelter of his lotus feet, of actually thinking of him and solving your problem in that way, because it's the only way to solve the problem. There's no other way to solve the problem. So I have to dig deeper. I have to actually read the Bhagavad Gita and apply it to my own life. In the 12th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, may I have a Bhagavad Gita? I'm going to read you a few verses that will solve all your problems. Would you like me to solve all your problems right now? Yes or no? Yes or no?
Yes.
Solve all your problems or not?
Yes.
Yes? Okay. Here it is. Would you rather have $1 billion right now, or would you rather have all your problems solved? Okay. I'll leave it in my bag then. You'd rather have $1 billion?
I would rather give $1 billion to solve all my problems.
He'd rather give $1 billion. Then accept it. That's true. This is a very good point. So Ramananda Sakaprabhu was saying, I'd rather give $1 billion. Just think, if you gave $1 billion away, how you'd feel if you gave it to build a temple and to print, give it to Mayapur Bihari when he walks in today. Say, Mayapur Bihari, because he's always in anxiety for Krishna. Mayapur Bihari, always in anxiety for Krishna. He's always, where is money for Bhagavad Gita's? Delete by also. That's all they think about, how to get money for Krishna. So if you walk up to him and say, here's all my money, I'm giving you everything I have, you give to my poor, would you be happier or more in distress in your life to give up everything you had to give to somebody like Mayapur Bihari? What do you think?
I'll be happy.
He'd be happy. So this proves that when we give to Krishna, then we think of Krishna, we become happy. Whereas when we try to hold on to anything in the material world, it just becomes a burden and we become more miserable, right? So here are the solutions to all our problems. We'll listen to what Krishna's instructions are of what makes someone dear to him. This is what makes a person dear to Krishna. And if you become dear to Krishna, then you'll think of him all the time and you'll be happy. Okay? Are you ready? One who is not envious, but is a kind friend to all living entities, who does not think himself a proprietor, and is free from false ego, who is equal in both happiness and distress, who is tolerant, always satisfied, self-controlled, and engaged in devotional service with determination. His mind and intelligence fixed on me. Such a devotee of mine is very dear to me. He by whom no one is put into difficulty, and who is not disturbed by anyone, who is equipoised in happiness and distress, fear and anxiety, is very dear to me. My devotee, who is not dependent on the ordinary course of activities, who is pure, expert, without cares, free from all pains, and not striving for some result is very dear to me. One who neither rejoices nor grieves, who neither laments nor desires, and who renounces both auspicious and inauspicious things, such a devotee is very dear to me. One who is equal to friends and enemies, who is equipoised in honor and dishonor, heat and cold, happiness and distress, fame and infamy, who is always free from contaminating association, always silent and satisfied with anything, who doesn't care for any residence, who is fixed in knowledge, and who is engaged in devotional service, such a person is very dear to me. Those who follow this imperishable path of devotional service and who completely engage themselves with faith, making me the supreme goal, are very, very dear to me. That solve all your problems? This is the process to become very dear to Krishna. And in these instructions is the practical directive in life through which we become happy also. Otherwise, there's no other adjustment other than becoming dear to Krishna than applying this imperishable path and these instructions, taking the imperishable path, following it, and applying these instructions to our life that will make us actually satisfied and happy. So that's our purpose in being here. It's to fill our mind with Krishna. You don't have to do anything else to become happy. There is no other solution. You have to fill your mind with Krishna. What are some other ways to fill your mind with Krishna? Go ahead, Ramananda Saka.
This is a question. So partly one of the when you read part of the verses was that one who is equal to both friends and enemies. How can we understand this being equal to enemies? Because when someone is an enemy, then the treatment is going to be different. For example, even in the case of exalted souls, like for example Pandavas, they had enemies, and their treatment was to kill the enemies or defeat them. But how can we understand it being equal to enemies? Means we treat them the same way as we treat friends, or we take some action because they are inimical.
It depends on your position in life. And for preachers, those who are on the Madhyama Adhikari platform, they avoid people who are envious. And here in the purport, Prabhupada says, you shouldn't become the enemy of your enemy. Someone becomes your enemy, don't become their enemy. It doesn't mean also that you have to cater to their demands to, disturb your life, but you avoid them to the best of your ability. And the point is that you see, a devotee sees, if I get an enemy somehow, if I'm in a situation where someone is acting as my enemy, the devotee doesn't see it in a dualistic way. He actually sees this is Krishna coming to me in a certain way to adjust my life. Because when the enemy comes to me, then I'm forced to do things in a different way. Maybe I have to increase my internal cultivation. As I mentioned before, Parikshit Maharaj, it seemed as if he had an enemy, Sringi. And Sringi cursed the king. He could have said, this is my enemy, and reacted. First canto, please. We find out in the instructions of Dharma, the bull, that if who was being beaten by Kali, could certainly say he was his enemy. And when Parikshit Maharaj asked, who has done this to you? Dharma said that he wouldn't name a perpetrator. He wouldn't name a perpetrator because as soon as I identify someone as the perpetrator, then I also become implicated in the whole process. So practically, I may see that all living entities are equal. Vidya vinaya sampane brahmane gavihastani shuni chaiva shupake cha pandita samadarshina. But that doesn't mean that I'll go offer my obeisances to a tiger and put my head at his feet, because he might bite my head off. Right? And a yogi, he may see everyone equally, but he won't therefore go sit next to a young girl, unmarried girl, because there is a way that the material energy works externally that he respects and understands, even though he sees this is a spirit soul in a young girl's body, this is a spirit soul in an old man's body, in an elephant's body. There is a practical way in which he adjusts his external workings. It's not that he just acts the same towards everybody in the practical sense. So internally, we may cultivate a sense that whatever enemy comes to me is actually by Krishna's arrangement to make me more fixed in filling my mind with Krishna and thinking of him, taking shelter of him, because I have an enemy. Externally, I may have a practical duty to perform. You know, for instance, if someone attacks your temple or something like that, then externally I'm duty bound. Of course, I'll go and protect the temple and defend against the activity. It's not that I'm not going to become the enemy of my enemy. He can do whatever he wants. Let him break down the door of the temple. No, we'll protect Krishna's house. So, but internally we may have a clear understanding that whatever is coming for some reason, for my own purification. So it's a difference in consciousness. That help? We'll also read the purport. One who is equal to friends and enemies. Purport, a devotee is always free from all bad association. This is text 18 and 19. Sometimes one is praised and sometimes one is defamed. That is the nature of human society. What is the nature of human society? Sometimes praised, sometimes defamed. One day praised, next day defamed. But a devotee is always transcendental to artificial fame and infamy, distress and happiness. He is very patient. He does not speak anything but the topics about Krishna. Therefore, he is called silent. Silent does not mean that one should not speak. Silent means that one should not speak nonsense. One should speak only of essentials. And the most essential speech for the devotees is to speak for the sake of the Supreme Lord. A devotee is happy in all conditions. Sometimes he may get very palatable foodstuffs, sometimes not, but he is satisfied. Nor does he care for any residential facility. Satyadev Prabhu was telling me on the way home on Wednesday night about going to Kumbh Mela with Srila Prabhupada in 1976, end of 1976 or beginning 1977. And there I said, how was it? And he said, very austere. Is freezing cold, and they all the devotees were staying in a tent. The bathroom facilities were primitive. Now, India, primitive bathroom facilities, just let your imagination, you can understand. Okay, then for bath, in the freezing cold in the morning, he'd have to go and, you know, well, not have to go. He had the privilege of going and taking bath in the Ganga, but he said that then the feet would be numb because it was so cold. And there was practically no way to get warm. And prasadam was khichdi with sand. Everything had some, you know, it was just because the wind was blowing and the, you know, whatever they're cooking outside, and then the little, you know, grits, dust and sand would get in the prasadam. So most austere conditions. But he said we were there with Prabhupada. And he said our tent was on the outskirts of, or not in a central location of the Kumbh Mela city. And therefore, He said Prabhupada told them every day to go do Harinam through the whole city. So they were with the Namhata, which was a big group of brahmacharis and devotees who were working under Guru Kripa Maharaj. And they every day they'd go out and for hours they'd walk through the city, the Kumbh Mela tent city, in Harinam. And he said as soon as the Harinam would start and they would go around, then all his troubles would be gone. And he'd see people in ecstasy watching the Harinam. It was the highlight of the Kumbh Mela, this big group of devotees chanting the holy names. And people would come out and they'd dance and they'd be in ecstasy. And he said, whatever coldness or anxiety or austerity, it was all finished by absorbing in the holy names and being engaged in devotional service. A devotee is happy in all conditions. Sometimes he may get very palatable foodstuffs, sometimes not. But he is satisfied. Nor does he care for any residential facility. He may sometimes live underneath a tree, and he may sometimes live in a very palatial building. He is attracted to neither. He is called fixed because he is fixed in his determination and knowledge. We may find some repetition in the descriptions of the qualifications of a devotee, but this is just to emphasize the fact that a devotee must acquire all these qualifications. Without good qualifications, one cannot be a pure devotee. Harava bhaktasya kuto mahadguna. One who is not a devotee has no good qualification. One who wants to be recognized as a devotee should develop the good qualifications. Of course, he does not extraneously endeavor to acquire these qualifications, but engagement in Krishna consciousness and development and devotional service automatically help him develop these. Then we have text number 14. And in this purport, Prabhupada said, coming again to the point of pure devotional service, the Lord is describing the transcendental qualifications of a pure devotee in these two verses. A pure devotee is never disturbed in any circumstances, nor is he envious of anyone, nor does a devotee become his enemy's enemy. He thinks, this person is acting as my enemy due to my own past misdeeds. You see? It's a matter of what we're thinking inside our heart. We don't become our enemy's enemy. So it is better to suffer than to protest, he says. Susamikshamano, tatenu kampam susamikshamano bunjana evatmakritam vipakam. Whenever a devotee is in distress or has fallen into difficulty, he thinks that it is the Lord's mercy upon him. He thinks, thanks to my past misdeeds, I should suffer far, far greater than I am suffering now. So it is by the mercy of the Supreme Lord that I am not getting all the punishment I am due. I am just getting a little by the mercy of the Supreme Personality of Godhead. But externally, Arjuna did his duty. He went and fought. But detached action. One who sees action and inaction and inaction and action is wise among men, Krishna says, doesn't he? So understanding that Arjuna is acting, but he's not acting the way a common man fighting an enemy would be fighting. He's acting for Krishna. It's transcendental service. It has nothing to do with a sense of revenge. Helpful? Okay. And then also very instructive in this, this whole section about the punishment and reward of Kali. Hare Krishna. We're just feeling fortunate today. We're all feeling very fortunate. Right? Aren't we all? We're very, very fortunate. We discovered this morning that even in material estimation, we're multi-billionaires, each one of us. Do you want me to prove it? Malini? We would give you today $1 million for one of your arms. Would you sacrifice an arm for $1 million? Yes or no? No? How about 10 million? How about $1 billion for two arms? No? Two arms for $1 billion. Come on, you could buy new ones for that much. That means you're a walking billionaire. What to speak of your feet? What to speak of your eyes? How much would you give for your eyes? Someone says, $1 billion for your eyes. Just give me both eyes, I'll give you $1 billion. Would you do it? Billions, billions, billions. This material body, labvam sudur labhamidam bahusambhavante. It's the most rare acquisition. We've been given it as a gift, Bhagavatam says. So just from a starting position, just from the fact that we've been given this great gift, we're souls, but we've been given this vehicle that is inestimably valuable, that we wouldn't give it up even for $1 billion, one arm, one leg, even one finger. Well, maybe a finger for $1 billion. I don't know. It's been done before. But this gift that we have, starting with understanding how we've been giving a gift by the material nature, and that this body is specifically equipped to understand Krishna, and we have a window of opportunity now in this human form of life, and somehow we've been born on this planet in which Chaitanya Mahaprabhu just recently performed his pastimes, which we have the wealth of Vedic literature, and we have this assembly to come together and talk about Krishna. And the theme today is filling your mind with Krishna. And we decided before you got here that the only solution in life for happiness is to fill one's mind with Krishna. Because every other adjustment we looked at, we did look at all the possibilities about location. We can move your location. You can move from one place to another. You can have more money, less money. We tried all different kinds of combinations. And we discovered amongst ourselves that none of these solutions would actually satisfy us permanently, maybe for a few minutes, but not permanently. But then we found out that if we fill our minds with Krishna, for instance, thinking of his lotus feet, and we talked about how his lotus feet are very beautiful, about how they're all merciful, they're like a boat to cross over the material world. Someone said, when just by thinking Krishna's lotus feet, then the whole material world and all its anxieties and problems shrinks up to this size, to the water contained with the hoofprint of a calf. And we also remembered that Krishna has markings on his lotus feet, like a thunderbolt, the flag, the wheel, and that when yogis meditate on that thunderbolt, and when they're in their deep meditation, did you all do deep meditation this morning? Did you sit down and meditate deeply on the holy name? Did you think of the holy name? Did you pray with all your heart, please, Krishna, save me, let me engage in your service? Because if you didn't, I think you should go back and revisit your japa. If you sit down in deep meditation on the holy name of the Lord, the yogis, they remember the thunderbolt marking on the lotus feet of Krishna. And do you know what that does? You know what it does. What does it do? It smashes the mountains of sin that are there within the heart of the yogi. Just by thinking of that thunderbolt, just as a huge thunderbolt of Indra can come and smash a mountain and pulverize it into powder. So similarly, that thunderbolt on Krishna's lotus feet, if I think of it, if I meditate on it, it's profound, just his lotus feet, just by thinking of his feet. Manmana, Krishna says, just think of me, fill your mind with me. If you just do that, then all the sins will be smashed. And that's the problem. All my problems and distress in life come from sinful reactions. And those come from ignorance. And if I think of Krishna, I'm no longer in ignorance because, well, the sun has come back out. Hare Krishna, welcome back. Just by thinking of Krishna or his devotees, then we immediately become happy. And it doesn't matter what our external circumstances are. It doesn't matter who said what to us. It doesn't matter where I live. It doesn't matter what quality of food I've been being given to eat. Any of these things become inconsequential for a person who feels satisfaction in their heart about Krishna. And our premise is that the main goal in life for those who are advanced, for those who are progressive, is to fill their minds with Krishna. Because by doing that, then all problems will be solved. Do you buy it? Do you buy this premise? 100%? Why? She can explain. Give her the microphone. Why are you here? Go right ahead.
Yesterday, I had a one-on-one meeting with my boss, and then he asked me, in general, because he was asking everybody, so he asked me, "Are you happy?" And I immediately replied saying that I'm very happy. And he was surprised that I never heard this answer before. And then so he asked me, like, there are so many issues and everybody's complaining about how bad it is, how bad that is, how bad the environment is. How is that you're saying you're happy? And then I said, like, I know that there are worse problems in this life than just this, these job. And then he said, that is so right. And he said that when the sky is falling, a person who is shorter, who complained through his entire life that I'm shorter, I'm not tall enough, will be so happy that the person who is tall is going to be affected first. So he feels satisfied. Mm. So he was actually, that was a good analogy that I heard. So that's what I told him, that if you have some real wealth and if you know that this is not the real problem, there are much more worse problems than that, then you're not very morose or you're not very unhappy. And then that was nice. And then I was thinking that how being Krishna conscious or just coming to the temple, just hearing katha, even you're in midst of so many problems, you still feel you're happy. At least happier than other people around you. So you feel miserable within yourself that you're not doing much in devotional service, but still you're happy.
Hare Krishna, sir. Nice to see you. This is a revelation. This is practical application. We have to work. We have to be out in the world and we have to integrate. It's not that we can just stay in this temple room 24 hours a day and maybe the mind would revolt on that also. But there's a practical way from the position we're in now, whatever work we have to do, whatever kinds of things we have to extricate ourselves from or deal with on a daily basis because we're obligated, if we do it by keeping Krishna in our mind, by filling our mind with Krishna, then we'll become successful, otherwise not. And what I've found, and I've been thinking about a lot lately, is that everyone has some kind of implication, some entanglement in this material world that is complicated. And the reason I'm seeing this more and more is because I'm talking to more devotees, doing more counseling and things. And everyone I meet, no matter where they are in the world, has some complicated situation. Do you think there's anyone in this world that has it's just easy? That there's, like, how is your life? It's just easy. There's no problem whatsoever. Someone whose mind is filled with Krishna may say that, just like you told your boss, you know, and he's surprised. Like, no one ever says that. And the fact is, when you dig deeper and you look, everyone has something to, some way, some complicated situation to extricate themselves from. And it may have to do with their involvement with their family. There's so many different family combinations that are funny. Like, everyone's laughing. Because just think about it. Like, you're born into a certain family and then you want to become Krishna conscious. And now there's all these combinations. It's like threads are tangled in all different ways, and everyone has some unique situation. How am I going to get out of this one? This way or that way or this way? They're tangled up in all that kind of situation. So one thing to remember, if you're feeling anxiety, and everyone does feel anxiety in this world. This world is called Kuntha. It's full of anxiety because of our identification with the mind and the external circumstances that we have to undergo here. Remember this, everyone's in a similar situation. It's not just you, it's everyone. Every living entity, actually. Even the lower living entities. I watch the little birds in my yard, because Jesus said to, he said, watch the birds in the yard. So I watch the birds, and he said, watch the birds in the field. So I look out and I say, okay, birds, let's see what you got. And I watch them, and you know, to some degree, they're relatively happy. But they also have their anxieties. They're looking above, the smaller birds are looking above to see if the bigger birds are going to come and eat them. And they're also worried about the cat. There's a cat. It's not my cat, but he's adopted me. I didn't adopt him. He just comes in the yard and goes, nice yard. And I'm going, all right, help yourself. And, you know, the birds are looking around and they're like, you know, is he with you or, you know. And so they're worried, even though they're getting their food naturally and everything like that, they have some anxiety, the little birds. And everyone from the bird up to Brahma has some kind of anxiety. So you're not in it alone. It's not that you're the only one who has a unique a set of anxiety and that it's complicated. And you say, yeah, but mine's different. It's very complicated. Really, it's different. For everyone, it's complicated. Everyone. There's a complicated situation. Look at the life, Srila Prabhupada's life. He set an example as an acharya. He had a complicated home life that he ultimately extricated himself from by Krishna's arrangement. Krishna, he said it. Prabhupada said, you know, Krishna extricated me from this situation. And his work, you know, he had a job, everything was going okay, and then it got smashed. He used the word dismantled. Krishna dismantled the whole thing. How do you feel about that? When your livelihood's dismantled, what do you do now? There's only one answer. You have to fill your mind with Krishna. And that's just what Prabhupada did, just filled his mind with Krishna and Krishna activities. And then you have a solution. Otherwise, not. Otherwise, there's more entanglement upon the entanglement upon entanglement. And there's no way to get out of it. But bidyate hridaya granchis chidyante sarva samshaya shiyante chasya karmani drishta eva manishvare. This process of filling one's mind with Krishna means that you can then cut that knot. You can extricate yourself. You can cut yourself out from it. But while we're entangled in it, it seems very difficult and so much anxiety in that. So we're coming together here to practice, actually practice what Krishna says in the Bhagavad Gita. We actually have to apply it. It's not theoretical. It's actually applied. We have to say, I'm going to apply this today, right now in my life, in this situation. Oh no, not this situation. This is different. My situation of anxiety is different. It doesn't relate to Bhagavad Gita. That's scripture. This is me. This is my life. No, it's practical. You actually have to apply it in your life today. It's unfair. Well, that's the nature of this world. It'll seem inequitable. It'll seem unfair. Because there are a lot of complications here. I may have done so many things in the past. When I think back to just the things I've done in this lifetime, I have so much sin to pay for just because of this one lifetime. What to speak of millions of lifetimes in the material world? How complicated is that? But Krishna's made it easy. He just says, Sarva dharman parityaja mame kam sharanam braja aham tom sarva papi bhyo moksha ishami masuja. I'll liberate you. Don't worry about a thing. Just do this one thing. Think of me. That's it. Just think of me and take my instructions in the Bhagavad Gita. And if you do that, by my grace, you'll be able to navigate your way out of the material world. Otherwise, what does he say? If you don't take my instructions, if you don't become conscious of me, what'll be the result? You'll be lost. And it's not fun being lost. And you get lost in the mind. The mind takes me on a ride and says, you know, if I just had this, if I just had that, if this person would just go away, if this would just be, then, yeah, see, everyone's laughing. People cause problems. You know, social intercourse is very difficult, you know, dealing with people because people don't do things the way I want to do them. Let's do it this way. No. Let's do it the other way. Why not? Why can't I have it my way? Well, you can go on feeling friction the rest of your life, or you can apply the principles of the Bhagavad Gita, and you can work through it. And so that's what we're advocating here. It's the International Society for Krishna Consciousness. That means fill your mind with Krishna. It's the simplest thing. Manmana, manmana bhava. You have to fill your mind with Krishna. And fortunately, Krishna is all attractive, he's all powerful, he's all merciful. Just by thinking of him, all problems are solved. Everything becomes possible when one thinks of Krishna. So it is our only option. And therefore, we suggest only this one thing, that you must fill your mind with Krishna. And there are many ways to do that, because Krishna is unlimited. He comes through his internal energy in many different ways so that we can think of him. But I'm really, this is it. This is the end of the line. There's no more. That we have to think of Krishna right now. This is the system. And we have to apply this system wherever we are in any circumstance. So just bringing you up to date, this is the theme and mood of the class today, that we have to take shelter of Krishna and fill our mind with Krishna and not expect that the material the nature will be kind to us, that it will be equitable, that I deserve some special treatment here in the material world, that I will get some special treatment. And if I'm not getting what I need or what I want here in this world, if I just adjust my external circumstance, then I'll get it. What do you think of that? Have you found through external adjustment that you get what you want? Have you found that?
I found that the external adjustment itself adjusts to give more distress.
What is it?
If we adjust, then external situation also adjusts to continue.
Yeah, that's true. You know, I'll give you a very simple practical example about how you can never get comfortable. When I go to somebody's house, or even in my own house, this happens all the time. Say I start feeling cold, right? So then I have a sweater. So I grab my sweater, I put on my sweater. Immediately someone will go run and turn on the heat. They go, he's cold, turn on the heat. So the heat goes on, my sweater goes on, and now I get hot. So me, I take my sweater off, and they go to run, and they turn down the heat again. This is sort of a paradigm for the material world, and I notice it wherever I go. Anybody's house, even in a car, I'll be riding in the car, and all I'll do is just move the little, the air conditioner is going too much, so I just move the little vent to the right, and then the person turns the air conditioner off, and now I'm too hot. So you try to make a move in the material world one way or another, and then it'll adjust on you the other way. Someone's like, oh, you're too hot, and turn it the other way. So as you move in this world, it adjusts against you. So obviously not the solution. You can't find it through that kind of thing. One thing that's very important is to overcome moroseness or to overcome anxiety is to think of service. When you think of how to do good for others, rather than what is my situation right now, then you actually become radiant. You know, people who are meditating, how, like right now, if you just change your, of course, you're already all thinking like this, so that's not a very, Hare Krishna, Raksha. So it's not a very good group population to experiment with. But if someone's in anxiety and they're thinking, woe is me and I have a hard time in life, if you give that person a project that think of a person today that you could do some good for, like let's all think of what we could do for Malini today. All of a sudden we just said, our project today is to do something nice for Malini. And as soon as we start thinking about that, how we can do something for Malini, then immediately our sense of service awakens. And we're thinking outside ourselves about what is my crummy situation in life. And we start to think about how to make somebody else's situation in life better. And this service attitude comes out of us and we become happy. It works, doesn't it? If you just think of how to take care of somebody else and forget about your own problems. And you look at people, even in history, who are philanthropists and things like that, who just dedicate their lives to serving other people. They become much happier than someone who's thinking about how to adjust their own material situation. What to speak of when someone thinks of doing the best kinds of service and of serving Krishna, which includes serving his devotees. Then such a person becomes blissful and happy in whatever situation they're in. I've seen it with sometimes when somebody's, devotees are very hungry and they come for prasadam, but then the devotees who are most blissful in the whole environment are the ones who are serving out prasadam. You know, serving prasadam to devotees. In Mayapur, we used to have this prasadam hall. Of course, there's bigger prasadam halls now, but there was just one small hall. And the most blissful service was serving the devotees who had come. Practically, it was all the devotees of ISKCON. They would come to Mayapur once a year, many of them. And they'd sit down in the hall. And what a coveted service it was to be on that team that was serving the prasadam several times a day. They're very organized, and they go around and serve prasadam. But immediately, as you're going around and you're giving prasadam to others, then do you have any hunger? No, you just feel happiness and bliss. And you're watching other people take prasadam. So in the same way, when we fill our mind with Krishna, which really means fill our mind with thinking of how to serve Krishna, then we immediately become satisfied and happy. Filling our mind with Krishna. This is the idea. This is what Krishna gives us, this directive. He said, just think of me. Fill your mind with thoughts of me. Any reflections so far? Yes, Dikshit.
Yeah, when I heard this lecture, all this is summarized by one verse by Madhvacharya. This is a beautiful verse. I mean, very difficult to sing. He says that, do your occupational duty by surrendering everything to. But always remember the lotus feet of Hari. Hari is the supreme. Hari is the teacher. Hari is the world existing. And Hari is your mother, father. And Hari is your aim. So the verse is, it's difficult to sing, but I'll try. Kuru bhungshu cha karma nijam niyatam Hari pada vinam radiya satatam Hari reva paru, Hari reva guru, Hari reva jagat Pitru matru gati Kuru bhungshu cha karma nijam niyatam Hari pada vinam radiya satatam Hari reva paru Hari reva guru Hari reva jagat Pitru matru gati. And then he follows up with another beautiful verse that explains like there is no other shelter than Krishna. He says that natatosya param jagati tetamam. That means there is no one who is supreme and in this universe and natato. Natatostya param jagatityatamam paramat parata purushottamata tadalam bahuloka vichintanaya pravanam kur manasamishapadi. He says clearly there's no other supreme person. Need not waste your time serving other people, trying to waste your time, and there's no one who is better than him. And so, tadalam bahuloka vichintaya. Just don't worry. Tadalam means stop it. Stop the nonsense. Mm-hmm. Bahuloka vichintaya. Vichintaya means thinking. Chintaya means bahuloka. Means thinking about different things. And chintaya means thinking. And pravanam kuru. That means surrender your manasa. Means mind. Ishapate. Means feet of the Lord. So.
Give my hand. Well, I know I feel better. That was beautiful. And I like that there's a few sutras in there. I like that one, stop the nonsense. Stop the nonsense. No more nonsense. Only thinking of Krishna, the supreme goal. This is the mood of Rukmini when she said, I'm not marrying any husband that's got mustache hairs and filled with all kinds of urine and stool and his body is decrepit and falling apart and will rot in this material. I want the Sakchidananda Krishna. No more nonsense. This is the mood of the devotee. I'm not settling for this crummy material world anymore. I'm not taking it anymore from my mind who's suggesting these things. No more nonsense. Only fill your mind with Krishna. And this vibration that he just sang, it was so pleasing, to bring my mind and my heart to this determination that I won't take anything else. And is it easy? No, it's an onslaught of material nature will come at me in such force to try to dissuade me in every way. Etam saastaya paratmanishtam adyasitam purvatamarma harshibi aham tarishami durantaparam tamomukundangri nishevayaiva. The Avanti Brahman, who Lord Chaitanya admired so much that he took this verse from the Avanti Brahman. The Avanti Brahman had given up all the nonsense. He had tried his hand at material life, and it all fell apart. And that's what always happens. There's an aphorism in Bengal that says, I've built this beautiful house for my pleasure and enjoyment, and now it has burned to the ground. There you go in a nutshell with the material world. And so the Avanti Brahman, although he gave all he could to enjoying material life, it all got dismantled and it was taken away from him. But some good fortune arose in his heart that he felt this detachment and determination to take the devotional service. And he said, stop the nonsense. No more material world. I'm going off to think of Krishna in all circumstances, wherever I am, and I'm just going to wander. And that's what he did. And when he went away from his home life, he was tested in so many ways. People came at him from every direction and harassed him. They stole his water pot, that was his only possession, and they sometimes chained him up and they beat him, and they uttered foul language at him. They would throw stool on him. They would pass foul air in front of him and make fun of him. And they would say, oh, you're such a great sage. Your mind is fixed just like a duck. And they would just say the most vile things to this great soul who was endeavoring. He's just trying to walk away from the entanglement in the material world. But he got attacked from every direction. But he went on. He just went on. And his determination was epitomized in the verse, Etam sa astaya paratma nishtam adyasitam purvatamar maharshibi aham tarishami durantaparam tamomukundrangri nisheva. I shall cross over the insurmountable ocean of material existence by being firmly fixed in the service of the lotus feet of Krishna, Paramatma, the supersoul who is situated in everyone's heart. This was approved by the previous acharyas who were fixed in firm devotion to the Lord. And so following the footsteps of the previous acharyas who had fixed their minds on Krishna against all odds, he took the same determination. And Chaitanya Mahaprabhu liked this very much. So he also repeated this shloka, Etam sa astaya paratma nishtam adyasit. Yes, it's in your shloka book. Tam sa astaya paratma nishtam adyasitam purvata marma aham turishami durantaparam, that I will cross over this difficult ocean of material existence. Etam sa astam 279 in the shloka book. Etam sa astaya paratma nishtam adyasitam purvata marma harshibi aham Tarishami Durantaparam. Durantaparam. It's very difficult to overcome this world. But with great determination, following the footsteps of the previous great souls, I will make a determined effort to go beyond this material world. Think of Krishna. Yes, Rakshit Chariwala Prabhu. We need the microphone in quadrant 3, please.
When... We read in the Bhagavad Gita where Krishna himself is saying that fix your mind upon me, think about me, offer your obeisances to me, become my devotee. So one thing is fixing oneself to do service for Krishna. The other thing, when it comes to fixing one's mind on Krishna and also thinking about him, this is the response that occurs, that one may ask, would I lose consciousness of other things that are happening around me? To translate it simply is, would I get preoccupied with that such that I may become unaware of other things that are going on around my surroundings? Because we would appreciate that we need to be aware of surroundings as well. So we are fixing our mind on Krishna, we are thinking about him. Am I also maintaining awareness of the surroundings and what is happening around me, or am I getting preoccupied and losing that?
Well, we can look at examples of those who are thinking of Krishna and at the same time doing their work. And one is Arjuna. Out of love, Arjuna served Krishna and fought the battle of Kurukshetra. And he was thinking of Krishna at the same time, because that was Krishna's order. He said, fight and think of me. And he was the most expert. It wasn't that he lost his concentration because he was thinking of Krishna while he was fighting, But actually, he became even more expert because now he was doing it for Krishna, and he was meticulous in how he executed his duty. So the devotee who's thinking of Krishna and working at the same time, which is Krishna's instruction, which you know well, it's in the 8th chapter of the Bhagavad Gita, right? Tasmat sarveshu kaleshu mamanusmara yujacha mayarpita manobhudhir mami vaishatya samshaya. That, you know, go on, think of me, and at the same time do your work. That devotee actually becomes more expert in doing his or her duty, you know, for Krishna, and thinking of him at the same time.
And one would also be able to maintain general awareness of what's going on.
Yes, yeah, that would be required. Krishna is Hrishikesh, he's the master of the senses. So when we engage our senses in ordinary activities, and we're aware of Krishna at the same time when we're doing some duty, then it's actually Krishna who's creating our awareness anyway. You know, he's the source of our awareness, and any expertise that we have, sarvasya chaham hridisani vishto matak smritir ghanam apovanam cha, whatever intelligence or forgetfulness is coming from Krishna anyway. There are examples, however, in extreme ecstasy of devotees who might, you know, forget their external surroundings. I mean, there are the story of Vidura, for example. When Krishna came to the house of Vidura, he and his wife became so excited to see Krishna and to feed him. They, instead of giving him bananas, which is all they had at the time, they were handing them the peels and throwing away the banana because they were just overwhelmed in some kind of ecstasy. So there are examples of that also. But in the normal course, we see that someone who's a devotee is expert. A devotee, that's one of the qualities of a devotee, is daksha. So, you know, in taking care of accounting, for instance, a devotee doesn't just, you know, sloppily do everything. Prabhupada, for example, was very meticulous in keeping accounts. You can see even his records coming over in the Jaladutta. Obviously, he's thinking of Krishna all the way over because he's coming to do Krishna's work, but he's writing in his diary every single penny that he's spending because he's thinking, I'm accountable for Krishna. So when you're keeping accounts for Krishna, you're thinking this is Krishna's money. So you're keeping a record of it. So you're keeping accurate records, but you're also thinking of Krishna at the same time. So it's not mutually exclusive. The two things go well together. So, yes. Anything else? Yes. Quadrant 1 microphone. Where's quadrant 2 microphone? Okay, yours is there. It's quadrant 3. We're all set with our quadrants. 1, 2, and 3. All right.
So, I have one question. Is like, to think about the Krishna and engage our mind the Krishna. So the one question is, so many, you know, since couple of days moving around my mind, like, to develop a faith is a natural process or is kind of something we have to focus our mind to develop a faith in Krishna, or like we do the meditation and the chanting so we can, you know, take a holy name. So what's, you know, how to develop a faith in ourselves?
Faith is what we're made of. Naturally, we have faith in Krishna. But when that gets covered over by the three modes of material nature, then that faith gets perverted in different ways. And it gets misdirected. There's nobody that doesn't have faith. Everyone has faith. It's just what you have faith in. So some people have faith in the government, and you can just drive around Silicon Valley, and there's one sign that I see on the 101 freeway on somebody's business, and it's a big picture of the American flag, and it says, "These colors don't run." It means, you know, we're not afraid. We don't run away from anybody. You know, come on, let's fight. And there's a sense that, you know, I have faith in America. I don't care what anybody says. I have faith in America. I don't care if it's going to hell in a handbasket. I still have faith in America. Right? So somebody has, there's faith. They have faith in that. And somebody else might have faith in you know, a rock and roll band, and they follow them everywhere they go. There are some people called deadheads. You ever heard of a deadhead? You ever heard of the Grateful Dead? Did you ever hear of the Grateful Dead? Anybody hear of the Grateful Dead? Yeah, they're a famous rock and roll band, and they became icons in the counterculture. They traveled everywhere, and they would do their music, and then the people would travel with them everywhere. It was like a traveling show. You know, wherever they went, the people, they would camp out, and they would just live for the Grateful Dead to hear their music and to be part of that culture. So they had faith in the Grateful Dead. And if you look anywhere, people have faith in somebody somewhere. But when we purify our faith, that pure faith that comes out, this is faith in Krishna. Shraddha shabde vishwas kahi surida nishchoy Krishna bhakti koile sarva karma krita hoy. Real faith, strong faith, means that I clear away these obstructions, and my impetus is that if I just serve Krishna, then everything else will be done perfectly. I don't have to do anything else. So yes, the faith is already there, but you have to purify it. Nitya siddha Krishna prema sadya kabunoi shravanadi shuddha chite kare udoy. Means naturally you have that love and faith in Krishna within your heart, but when you purify it by hearing the sound vibration from the spiritual world and all the coverings go away, then that really strong faith in Krishna will come out. So as you continue in your process of hearing and chanting in a regulated way, then gradually the unwanted things will be separated out, and then your pure faith will become very strong. Does that help?
It's really helped a lot. Thank you, Prabhu.
Okay. Okay, great.